Characteristic features of quantum mechanics. People might give various answers to that. What mathematical features of theory give rise to these physical features? To what extent are these features independent or interdependent? And I guess inspired by these questions, people have attempted to construct what I call quantum-like theories, theories which have some features of quantum mechanics but lack others. And I suppose examples of those would be theories where the non-locality goes beyond that in quantum mechanics, like the PR box theories, and also one that I'm going to concentrate on today, toy theory of qubits proposed by Rob Speckens. All these theories are phrased in quite different mathematical terms. Quantum mechanics uses Hilbert spaces, linear maps. Rob's theory, for example, uses sort of subsets of a set of states and relations between them. And the fact that they're expressed in these different terms can make it difficult sometimes to identify the similarities, that the common structures that might be there between the theories. So what this talk is about is trying to bring these different quantum-like theories into a sort of a common mathematical framework so that we can more easily identify common structures and also pinpoint differences between them. And the common mathematical framework we're going to use is the Dagger symmetric monoidal categories approach that we've heard a bit about already. Bob and Ross both spoke about that on Monday. We're going to concentrate in particular on sort of two test cases. They are stabilizer quantum mechanics, which is a restricted version of quantum mechanics where we just concentrate on qubits and on the stabilizer states of the qubits. And secondly, on Rob's toy theory. Both these theories have a lot of features in common, but there are also quite important differences between them. I guess the most important, really, or one of the key differences, is that Rob's toy theory is, by construction, a hidden variable theory, a local hidden variable theory, and stabilizer quantum mechanics is definitely non-local. It can't be modeled by local hidden variables. Okay, so if I just give a rundown of what I'm going to say, I will run through, introduce stabilizer theory and the toy theory in a bit more detail. Then we'll look at how we can put both of those theories into the same common categorical framework. We will identify, using this categorical approach, structures that occur in both theories. And we'll also pinpoint a difference between the two theories. This will be something called the phase group, which I think Ross talked about on Monday. This is an abelian group which turns up when we look at these common structures. And we'll see how this, this mathematical difference between the two theories in categorical terms relates directly to the, one of the key physical differences between the theories, the locality or non-locality. And finally, if I've got time, we'll talk about how both the stabilizer theory and the toy theory are both examples of something that we're going to call a mutually unbiased theory. And we'll show that, to some extent, the locality behaviors of these mutually unbiased theories are classified by phase group and thus by abelian groups. Okay. I should say a few words about this framework that we're going to use. We've seen this quite a few times already, these diagrams, and heard quite a bit already about this categorical framework. I guess the key point, I'll just reiterate a few things quickly. Most physical theories can be seen as instances of a symmetric monoidal category where the objects are systems and the arrows are processes undergone by those systems. It's been mentioned already that we've got a nice graphical language for reasoning about monoidal categories. Here, if we've got a functor, an arrow f between A and objects A and B, we represent that by this box here. And I think this makes clear that the way we're going to interpret this is the arrows are processes which systems undergo. A monoidal category is appropriate for physical theories because we can take two systems, put them side by side, and we've got a composite system. And that's what's represented by this monoidal operator here. And this is how we represent it in terms of the graphical language. I'm aware that I'm complicating things even more because some people go bottom to top with the diagrams, some go top to bottom, and I go left to right. Don't believe anyone goes right to left. I haven't seen that yet, but we represent the monoidal unit object in the graphical language by nothing. That's convenient, good shape. A morphism of this type going from nothing into A, from I into A, represents preparation of system A in some state psi. I should also add that the theories that we're going to be looking at when expressed as categories are dagger categories. Basically, that means that for every arrow that we have going from A to B, we have a corresponding arrow, F dagger, going from B to A. This is an involutive operation. Okay. So I should introduce the two theories that I'm going to contrast. The first of these is stabilizer theory. Okay. Okay. In this case, this is a restricted version of quantum mechanics, and our only systems of interest are qubits and sort of compound systems of several qubits, or as many qubits as we like. And we also restrict our attention to the stabilizer states. The stabilizer states, I guess the full definition is that they're eigenstates of tensor products of Pauli operators. But the details of that aren't so important. The sort of salient points to note are that there are a discrete set now, rather than the continuous set of states on the Bloch sphere. We just have these six states in the case of a single qubit. Three pairs of orthogonal states here. These are the eigenstates, obviously, of the Pauli X, Y, and Z. If we go to two qubits, then we get the stabilizer states that we get are all the tensor products of these states here, and also a collection of fully entangled states, the Bell states, and states that are local unitary equivalent to the Bell states. The operations that we have in this theory are ones which preserve the stabilizer states. So under sort of normal unitary evolution, these are operations known as the Clifford operations. They form a group, the Clifford group, and if we restrict attention to single qubit states, then we have the single qubit Clifford unitaries, which form a group S4, the permutation group. Okay. Right. That's all I want to say about that. Next, Rob Speckens's toy theory. Okay, I'll have to get this right because he's in the audience. I could talk about this for quite a long time, actually. There's a lot to this theory, but I'll just have to give a very quick overview here of sort of what's going on. Again, there's only one type of system in this theory, and it's meant to be something like a qubit. But it looks quite different in this presentation. So one of these systems has four possible states that it can reside in. So here's the state space of one of these single systems. These states are, Rob calls them ontic states in theory. Now, the key point about this theory is there's a restriction on our knowledge of the ontic states. And, well, in simplified terms, when we're just looking at a single system, what this tells us is that we can know at best that the system is in one of two ontic states. And the state of our knowledge, Rob calls the epistemic state, and that is what's meant to be analogous to the quantum state. So you can see that there are sort of six epistemic states of best knowledge, given this restriction. And I've drawn them out here in a kind of a suggestive way on the block sphere. Obviously, you know, the rest of the block sphere isn't there, but I want to draw attention to the fact that, again, we've got six states, and they fall into three families of two. And if you think about it, when we do a measurement on one of these single states, because of this restriction on our knowledge, what we can do is we can ask, for example, is the system in state one or two, or is it in state three or four? That's an example of a measurement that we can do on one of these systems. And you can see that this state and this state are basically the two outcomes that we could get. Or we could do another measurement, ask, is it in state one, ontic state one, or state ontic state three, or is it in ontic state two or four? And again, these two here on opposite sides are the two outcomes that we can get from those measurements. So these are, the way they fall into pairs, they are something quite like the eigenstate of the different types of measurements that you can do in this theory. So this sort of restriction on our knowledge in the theory is then used to derive the types of transformations that the states can undergo, the forms of states for multiple systems. That doesn't concern us too much here. The toy theory can replicate a number of different characteristic features of quantum mechanics. It exhibits, well, for example, there's a no-cloning theorem on these epistemic states. You can teleport epistemic states using particular types of states on multiple systems. It's got, in some sense, complementary observables. But crucially, it's a hidden variable theory by construction, so we shouldn't expect non-local behavior to arise in this theory. Okay, so how do we bring these two theories into our categorical setting? Flip this around. Maybe I'll just do that and not mess around with it. Okay, so for example, the physical theory of quantum mechanics is described by the category Hilb, or FD Hilb for finite dimensional quantum mechanics, where the objects are the state spaces of the systems and the arrows are linear maps. Now, since stabilizer quantum mechanics is a sort of sub-theory of quantum mechanics, we would expect the category, which we're going to call STAB, to be a subcategory of F. Hilb, and that is indeed the case. Interestingly, we can actually build up STAB in a sort of a constructive fashion, which I'll describe here. The objects are the one-dimensional Hilbert space, two-dimensional, and arbitrary tensor products of those. The morphisms are the closure under these three operations, composition, tensor product, and taking the adjoint, of the following linear maps. Firstly, all of the single qubit Clifford operations, which, as we said before, form the group S4. And these two operations here, this one takes the computational basis vectors and copies them. And this one here is preparation of the plus state, the, where's that thing that I have to use to run? Is this the one? No. So the, this state here. Okay, it's not immediately obvious why this will give us all of the stabilizer states and operations. Basically, it comes down to the fact that using these and some of these, we can patch together a CNOT gate. The CNOT gate, along with all the single qubit Clifford operations, is enough to give us all n qubit Clifford operations. And then max state duality is enough to then give us all of the stabilizer states. Okay, what about the toy theory? Here we've got a category we're calling spec. This category turns out to be a sub-Bagger symmetric monoidal category of REL, the category whose objects are sets and whose morphisms are relations between the sets. The objects are single element set, four element set, and Cartesian products of those. So you see the doesn't all fit, but the way we define the two categories is quite analogous. The morphisms are the closure, this time under composition, Cartesian product this time, and relational converse of all permutations on the four element set. Again, forming the group S4. And these two relations here, which, well, the reasons for defining them like that are a bit opaque, but we'll, hopefully that will become clearer later on. Yes. Anything else I wanted to say about that? So the way that we construct these two categories is obviously quite analogous. But despite that, there's no particular reason, per se, why the categorical structure should be similar. But it is. They do share several key features, as we will now show. So the next sort of 10 minutes or so will probably be a fairly tedious series of definitions, even more tedious since you've already seen some of them before. Well, I really need to figure out this rotation. Aha, brilliant. All right. Okay, so I'm going to define some sort of abstract categorical structures, and then we'll see that they appear both in STAB and in SPEC. This is an observable structure we're now going to define. You can see that our terminology has gone through various stages here. At the moment, we're calling it an observable structure. Is that what you call it, Ross? Okay, it was a basis structure for a little while. You can't really decide, to be honest. If I say basis, I'm going to try really hard just to say observable structure. If I do say basis structure, it's a slip of the tongue and it means the same thing. So an observable structure comes when we have an object in the category. It needs to be a Dagger symmetric monoidal category for all these definitions to make sense. And we have two morphisms here, delta and epsilon, and they obey. Here are their representations in the graphical language, and they obey a series of axioms which make them an observable structure. Co-associativity, co-unit, co-commutativity, and a couple more. There we go. The Frobenius law, and isometry. Okay, and we're going to claim that these are the abstract counterparts of observables in our theories. That, at first sight, seems pretty hard to justify why, like, two operations like this, which obey a series of laws has got anything to do with an observable. We're justified, well, we justify this, firstly, in the case that in F. Hilb, these observable structures are in bijective correspondence with orthonormal bases. The way in which, the sort of concrete way in which this happens is exemplified by this operation that I use in the definition of stab. Here is an example, these two, of an observable structure. And the way they pick out an orthonormal basis is that this thing copies the basis. We know from the no cloning theorem that if a linear map is going to copy some basis, some vectors, then the most it can do is to copy orthogonal vectors. So this is the sense in which this type of map picks out a basis. I suppose more generally, we justify saying that this is the abstract concept of an observable by the way it interacts with certain types of states, which we're going to define, which then have properties similar to what we would expect for, say, eigenstates of an observable, or unbiased states with respect to an observable. That is what I should quickly add that in the definition of spec, unsurprisingly, the way I've defined these here, these also form an observable structure. So we're going to define a few sort of subsidiary notions. First off, an eigenstate. Again, you can see the terminology has gone through various stages. An eigenstate is a state, an eigenstate with respect to a particular observable structure is a state that is a morphism of type I to A. So in the graphical language, coming from nothing and going to this type of system, such that this operation here, the delta from the observable structure, copies the state. Now, in the case of, we go back to the definition of stab, obviously the classical, the eigenstates for this observable structure are these, the 0 and the 1. For this observable structure in stab, it turns out that, it turns out that if we go back to our states in the toy theory, this and this are classical, but are eigenstates for that observable structure. The next notion is that of unbiased state, and this is one for which this combination here is unitary. That's to say, if we use the dagger functor, turn this and take the adjoint of this thing, or which corresponds graphically to sort of flipping it round. So taking the adjoint corresponds graphically to being something like this, and then link them together, and we get the identity. Again, we justify this definition because in the case of F. Hilb and Stab, we get exactly the states which are unbiased to this observable. So if I go back to states from the stabilizer theory, we saw how the observable structure we looked at had these as eigenstates, and it's these four here which turn out to be unbiased according to our categorical definition. So it seems like a reasonable definition. Again, in the case of spec, the observable structure we looked at copied these two, and it's these four which turn out to be the unbiased state. Oh dear, running out of time. Finally, two observable structures are mutually unbiased when all states, all eigenstates of one are unbiased with respect to the other, and vice versa. And we saw these in Ross and Bob's talk, where they were using different colors to represent the different observable structures. Okay. Okay, next definition. Next feature. Right, if we use a dagger functor to an act on the delta morphism in the observable structure, we now get a morphism of this type here. And obviously we can act on two states and we get out something which is another state. So we've got this thing defines a binary composition law on states. And it turns out because of the way that we defined the observable structure, all of the diagrammatic laws that I put up when I first defined these things, this thing is in fact a commutative monoid on A and B. And the unit is this map epsilon delta because, well, this was one of the laws that we first used when we defined the observable structure. If furthermore we restrict to states which are unbiased with respect to this, these form a subgroup of the monoid, and this is what we term the phase group. The terminology comes from F. Hilbe, where when we're looking at the qubit, the unbiased states are the ones that sit on the equator of the Bloch sphere. So if we're looking at the observable structure with eigenstates 0 and 1, then the phase group is formed of all the states sitting here on the equator, and it's equal to U1. For Stab and for Spec, well, here we had four unbiased states, so our phase group is going to be a four-element phase group, and in this case, it's the cyclic group Z4. In the case of Spec, here again, we've got the four elements of the phase group. In this case, quite importantly, as we'll see shortly, we get a different group. Well, we get the only other four-element group, Z2 times Z2. Okay. Right, last bit of definition. It had better be. Is what we're going to call a GHZ structure. Yeah, okay. So we derive this from the observable structures. Here's our epsilon dagger, and here are two delta morphisms. And we get this thing here, a tripartite state. In the case of F. Hilbe and in Stab, we get exactly the GHZ state. And in the case of Spec, we get something which is something like the analog of the GHZ state. Just abstractly, we get various properties which you would sort of want from something that was going to be the equivalent of your GHZ state. For example, the symmetry between each of the different component systems. And our final concept is that of a correlation triple. So a correlation triple is a triple of states in the theory, morphisms of this type, such that if I plug in the adjoint of X and X prime into this GHZ structure here, then the outcome is the resulting morphism is this state here, X double prime. What is the significance of this? Well, these correlation triples tell you something about certain outcomes of measurements on GHZ states, which, well, it tells you that certain outcomes are allowed and certain outcomes are forbidden. For example, if we look at the quantum mechanical case, then if this thing is equal to x double prime. Now, suppose x double prime is an eigenstate of a particular observable, and we take a different eigenstate of that observable, and then we try and plug that into there. We're not going to get anything, right? We're going to get zero. The scalar in that case will be zero, which is telling us that there's no chance of that outcome occurring. Now, the same is actually true in spec. The same sort of thing happens if you take another eigenstate of the same observable of this and try and plug it in here, we get the zero scalar again. And with some extra assumptions on the types of scalars that we have, this is sort of a general property. So what these correlation triples are telling us, they're telling us about forbidden outcomes for certain measurements on the GHZ state. And it's perhaps not surprising, given the way that the GHZ structure is defined in terms of these components of the observable structure, that there's a link between these correlation triples and the phase group, or I suppose more generally, the monoid that we just saw earlier. And barring a couple of technical details, basically the relationship is this. All correlation triples are of this form. So when we're talking about unbiased states, then the phase group obviously determines the structure of these correlations on the GHZ state. Okay, how are we doing? All right. How long have I got? 45 minutes? Something like that? Not another 45, obviously, but I think I've got 15 more actually, NGS. Yeah. Okay, so having given all these, identified all these structures which occur in STAB and SPEC, we can have another look at their definition. So, bloody hell. Should have used a slightly better filing system here. Right? There we go. Okay. So, we know now that this forms an observable structure, as does this. And here, here we've got, well, let me switch to the next slide a bit easier. Essentially, the way that these categories are defined. Pretty much by the end of it. Basically, both of them are, if we don't worry about the internal structures of the objects and the morphisms, which we're not really worried about if we're thinking in categorical terms, then both categories appear to be constructed in almost the same way. We've got that our morphisms are the closure under composition, monoidal product, and dagger functor of a whole series of 24 morphisms of this type, Q to Q, which together combine according to this group here. And we've got an observable structure, and we certainly know how that combines. That's just by definition. So it's almost like they're the same category. Any difference between them is clearly going to have to come in the interaction between this and these two. So if we want to pinpoint a mathematical difference between the theories, it's there. In fact, a little bit of thought would show you that the phase group is basically exactly one of those sort of differences, the way that this really is a consequence of the interaction between these and these. And as I noted earlier, the phase group is a significant difference between the two categories. It's Z4, the cyclic group, in the case of, I shouldn't talk about the phase group of the whole theory. The phase group of particular observable structures on this theory is different. The observable structures on the single system object. In the case of STAB, we get the phase group Z4. In the case of, sorry, yes, that's right. In the case of SPEC, we get the phase group Z2 times Z2. I should probably realize that's like a crucial conclusion in this talk, and I haven't actually written it down anywhere on the slides. And what's nice is that this sort of, we've pinpointed a mathematical difference between the two theories, but it also corresponds directly to the physical difference between the two theories. Why is that? Well, we saw a minute ago how the phase group is basically what determines the GHZ correlations in the theory. Sorry, I should say the difference that I'm referring to is locality versus non-locality. And the phase group has a direct bearing on that because it determines the form of the GHZ correlations in each theory, and because the GHZ correlations are the key ingredient in probably the neatest no-go proof for local hidden variable theories, which I will recap very quickly. Probably a lot of people are familiar with this. I'm going to talk about I think the proof was first put in this form by Mermin. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But so suppose we've got 3 qubits. This is how the proof goes. And we've got them in a GHZ state. Now, suppose we make spin X measurements here, here, and here. Then we can get a number of different outcomes in that case. But there are certain combinations of outcomes which we will not get, which are forbidden, probability zero. So I'm using 1 and minus 1 to represent spin up, spin down in this case. So for example, if I measure X on each qubit, then I can get any of these 4 outcomes, but I can't get any of the other 4 outcomes that I might get. I've always got to get an odd number of spin up. So there's this sort of parity property which determines whether or not an outcome is forbidden or allowed. And then if I do another series of measurements, say measure X here, and then spin in Y direction there and there, then the types of outcomes which I'm allowed to get are different. The parity flips. And so this is true for all 4 of these different sort of triples of observables that I can measure. And the way the proof then goes is that basically you show that there's no consistent way to assign genuine real values to X and to Y for each of these qubits in a way that still will respect these parity conditions if you make the measurement. So in that way, we rule out the possibility of there being hidden variables here, which determine the outcomes of the measurements. Now, in our abstract setting, these sort of the parities that you get, the outcomes that are allowed, are exactly. This is basically what I was talking about when I mentioned GHZ correlations. A correlation triples. It's the correlation triples in your category which determine what kind of outcomes you're going to get. And since these are dependent on the phase group, if you like, the phase group determines those parities in the outcomes. And the fact that you get this contradiction, that you can derive this contradiction in the case of quantum mechanics, in the case of STAB, is directly due to the fact that the phase group of STAB is Z4. If the phase group was something different, Z2 cross Z2, for example, then the selection of parities you would get in the allowed outcomes of your measurements on the GHZ state would be different. And in this case, it's impossible to use them to derive the contradiction and to rule out hidden variables, which is a good thing, because we know that SPEC is in fact a hidden variable theory. So that's what we would expect. So I suppose the conclusion to be drawn from that is that the conclusion we're going to draw is that the phase group of the theory The phase group of the observable structures which appear in the theory is the sort of key structural element which tells us whether we've got locality or non-locality in the theory. But if we have observable structures with Z4 phase groups, then this sort of endows our theory with non-locality. Whereas a phase group, observable structure with a Z2 times Z2 phase group doesn't have this property. It's not going to endow a theory with non-locality. So I suppose in a sense we've identified the sort of structural origin of non-locality, at least in the case for stabilizer states and for qubits. I want to finish. I've got 3 minutes. Okay. Right. Yeah, I'm going to do a better job of this next time. Both STAB and SPEC, or the stabilizer theory and the toy theory, are sort of similar in a sense that they have a discrete number of observables, and all of these observables are mutually unbiased. And they are examples of what we'd like to call a mutually unbiased theory. So this is a theory expressible in as a dagger symmetric monoidal category. It's got observable structures, and they satisfy these properties. We've only got one type of system, basically, is what this one says. The observable structures are all alike. They have the same number of eigenstates. They have the same phase group throughout the theory. All observable structures are mutually unbiased with respect to one another. And all of the states are eigenstates of some observable. And these are interesting to us because of the following result, which I certainly don't have time to prove, so I will state. Okay, so if we have an observable structure on an object such that all states on Q are either eigenstates or unbiased with respect to it, and a bit of thought will tell you that that is exactly the case for a mutually unbiased theory, then the action of the monoidal multiplication on the states of this object is entirely determined by the phase group. Now, there are a lot of tedious details, but the way this works is actually fairly simple to state and outline. But if all of the states are either eigenstates or unbiased, well, we know what basis structures do to eigenstates. They copy them. That's just clear from the definition. And so all we need to know really is what they do to the unbiased states. And that is exactly given to us by the phase group. The nice thing about this is that, phase groups are abelian groups. They're finite abelian groups. And these are well understood and classified. We know all of them in principle. And so we can classify the observable structures that might appear in these mutually unbiased theories using these groups. And so in a sense, we can talk about, to some extent, we can classify the locality properties of all these theories using these groups. Although that's something of an ongoing project to actually get a rule for to take a given abelian group as your phase group and then deduce from that what the locality properties of the GHZ state are. Okay, I probably should leave it there.
Maybe one quick question.
Jamie? So you said that Z2 times Z2 seems local and Z4 seems non-local, right? Yeah. And that's because we expect that inspect to behave in that way. So, but do you mean because Z2 is a product state, that there's a product group?
No, that's not. For example, if you go to...
Why would you... What if you get some other category and you don't get a Z4 or Z2, you get some other thing?
Yeah.
Is that... How do you look at that phase group and determine if it's local or non-local?
This is the... ongoing work seeks to answer this question.
So there's no direct ways, there's nothing intrinsic about Z72 that screams it's a local theory. It's just you know spec is a local theory.
Well, you wouldn't have to go back to the fact, you wouldn't have to rely on the fact that, well, this is the one, this is the phase group for quantum mechanical theory and reasoning that way. You could actually just look at the correlations which would arise from Z4. You look at the phase group, translate that into what the GHZ correlations are, and then you can make exactly the same argument that Merman does with the GHZ state. You don't really need any reference to Hilbert spaces or to vectors or anything like that. It's just, you can actually just, from the phase group itself, you derive correlations which you can then...
So that's a totally pure mathematical process.
Yes.
Like taking a finite group and determining its local or non-local.
Yeah. Now, the thing is that we can sort of do that by hand, if you like, by inspection, in the case of this, because it's quite simple. What I'm looking at the moment is how to do that for arbitrary groups, but that's showing how to extend the Merman argument to larger numbers of, for example, where your observables have more than two outcomes. I don't know, it's a more complicated problem.
Okay, so let's thank our speaker again.